At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Another month, another lousy employment report. 263,000 jobs gone. Round and round the layoffs go. When they'll stop, nobody knows. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the second day of October. That jobs report from the Labor Department was far worse than economists were predicting. They put Carmack the Magnificent's cards to their foreheads and said, 190,000. Instead, it was 260,000 jobs lost. The unemployment rate also rose to 9.8%. That's the highest it's been in a quarter century. Pretty much no one is betting that we will stay below 10%. And it's looking like it'll be a good long while before it's all over. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Economists basically agree we're out of recession. That is, as measured by gross domestic product, the economy's probably growing again. And yet, unemployment keeps getting worse.
The labor market has fallen into a hole that is surprisingly enormous.
That's Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute. She says add the 250,000 or so jobs we keep losing every month to the 8 million jobs that have vanished since the recession began. Then add in all the jobs the economy didn't create that would have been needed just to keep up with young people entering the workforce.
The hole in the labor market is now around 10.7 million jobs. That is what we have to make up to get recovery in the real economy.
It'll probably be a year or more before employers hire enough new workers to start filling that hole. Part of the problem is that some old jobs, like in the auto industry, are gone for good, says Ken Matheny of Macroeconomic Advisors.
In some areas of manufacturing, while you would expect some cyclical improvement in employment, still, it doesn't mean that all the jobs that have been lost over the last several years are going to come back. In fact, they probably won't.
So where might millions of new jobs come from? Art Ayer of the Oregon Employment Department has looked at the prospects in his state.
And what that shows is a continuation of growth in private education and health services, hospitals, doctor's offices, dentist's offices, and so forth.
So, along with enough jobs to get the unemployment rate down, we'll probably get higher tuition and hospital costs, too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So that's a look at the big picture, but behind the numbers are a whole lot of people dealing with the everyday reality of unemployment. More people fighting for the same job and fewer jobs to fight over. We called a couple of folks on the front lines to get their take on the statistics.
Today, I had to go in a little early to a temporary job I had to be told that I no longer have it.
On Tuesday, I got turned down for a job I really wanted. I guess it would just kind of be the attitude of I'm going to make my own weather.
I spend 3 or 4 hours every day searching job boards, contacting people, and we haven't hit the bottom yet, even though they keep saying we're in the recovery mode.
Everything I hear says it's going to continue till probably middle of next year. I can't go that long. I have a mortgage. I have kids. That's pretty bad.
That was Keith Nelson of Minneapolis, Julia Kohler of Highland Ranch, Colorado, Wally Shellstad of Buffalo, Minnesota, and Lisa Strasner of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's been more than a year now since Lehman Brothers faded into the history books. The bankruptcy of the century-old investment firm left hundreds of creditors waiting to be paid pennies on the dollar. Today's Wall Street Journal reports that a court-appointed bankruptcy examiner is looking into whether the Federal Reserve improperly elbowed its way to the front of the line. Marketplace's Steve Henn picks up the story from Washington.
In the days leading up to the Lehman bankruptcy, the Fed lent the investment bank billions. And after Lehman collapsed, it stepped in again to help unwind all of the bank's pending deals.
It's really the lender of the last resort for the economy. And so it found it necessary to make sure these transactions cleared.
Bankruptcy expert Steve Jacobowski is the Coleman Law Firm in Chicago.
If the transactions didn't clear, it's like taking oil out of your engine.
The economy seizes up. As Lehman was collapsing, the Fed made very short-term loans to Lehman and other banks to keep the system's wheels turning. When it was all over, the Fed got paid back first. Now, a year later, the bankruptcy court is asking if by being first in line, the Fed was cutting off other creditors.
It's something that an examiner, I think, necessarily looks at. I don't know that anything is ultimately going to come of it.
Vincent Reinhart is a former Fed economist.
Yeah, generally the borrowing arrangements are written so that the Fed gets priority. So it's intentional, and they view it as effectively protecting taxpayers' funds.
In this case, that goal of protecting the taxpayers may not have played out exactly as intended. Citibank and the Bank of New York ended up holding more than $130 billion in Lehman debt. Ultimately, they may just get pennies on the dollar. And 12 months later, U.S. taxpayers have financed bailouts of both of these banks. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Sarah Palin's memoir hit the top of the bestseller lists at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Borders today. The former Alaska governor and vice presidential candidate's book is called Going Rogue, An American Life. But her fans will have to wait until November 17th to get their hands on a copy. And I say hands because there will be none of that newfangled Kindle-ing with this book, not until more than a month later, anyway. Publisher HarperCollins has decided to delay the release of an electronic version of the memoir until the day after Christmas. A column on the Slate website first made note of that. Senior correspondent Bob Moon wondered why publishers are taking different approaches to the e-reader challenge.
Certainly, there must be some kind of rational reason for leaving out users of Amazon's Kindle book reader, not just the Palin book, but also Ted Kennedy's memoir, True Compass, currently two of the hottest-selling titles.
What I see is an industry acting somewhat irrationally and against its own interests out of panic and fear.
Sarah Rotman Epps follows the fast-emerging e-book business for Forrester Research. She says it's a power struggle that reminds her of Apple's pricing dominance over music on iTunes.
What publishers are afraid of is that Amazon will play the role of Apple, taking revenue out of their pockets.
Amazon's top-selling digital versions commonly go for around $10, but Epp says publishers would prefer to charge list prices as high as $30 or $40. Fred Von Lohman represents the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He warns publishers are inviting piracy.
I do think that's going to become a real threat if publishers decide to take the view that people only get to read what they tell them to read in the format they tell them to enjoy at the price point that they insist on. That's exactly the kind of short-sighted, anti-customer attitude that landed the music industry in so much trouble.
Von Lohman says ebook readers are fast becoming a force to be reckoned with.
We've gone from a few hundred thousand people who have a Kindle overnight to millions of people who have an iPhone already in their pocket, and now that iPhone can be a book reader.
As Von Lohman explains it, the Internet has a way of solving problems, like it or not. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street did not appreciate the surprises contained in that unemployment report. Stocks fell for the fourth straight day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. was a pretty big week for goodbyes. Bank of America's embattled CEO Ken Lewis announced his retirement. So did Chevron's chief. General Motors' Saturn brand lost its last lifeline. The deal to sell it to Roger Penske collapsed. And it also appears the book may have closed on the public option for healthcare. Here with us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond is Felix Salmon from Reuters and Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine. Hello to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Tess.
So Senator Rockefeller's plan on health care was voted down, but there may be apparently some hope that Senator Schumer's proposal will have something in there. But before I get to you guys, I want you to listen to a very important clip from The Daily Show. This is their eminent health care analyst, Wyatt Cenac.
The Finance Committee has rejected the public option, so the Democrats can now keep it alive in a joint meeting with the Health Committee where it can get killed again in a larger, more humiliating forum.
So, Megan, what is going on here with the public option? Are reports of its demise greatly exaggerated?
I think that reports of its demise are sadly probably accurate. There's been a lot of back and forth. I think Clive Crook of my magazine pointed out the other day, the advocates of the public option have been saying two things that are completely incompatible. One is that the public option, it's going to compete fairly and it's not going to interfere with other people's insurance. And the other is that it's going to drive down costs in the market. And so liberals, of course, have been hoping that it's going to, you know, use Medicare pricing and basically sort of destroy the rest of the health insurance industry. And I think the core is that liberals were never going to get a public option which killed the healthcare industry. They might have gotten the kind of public option that doesn't matter all that much, but at that point, it's not really clear why they want it. The sort of odd thing is that they didn't save it to be used as a negotiating tool in the larger congressional debate. They killed it off in committee rather than allowing their senators to make sort of a public symbolic vote against the public option in order to buy political credibility on voting for the larger bill.
Well, then, Felix, you know, a lot of concessions have been made to try to get something passed here. What are the odds, if the public option is dead, that there's going to be something that's affordable for folks?
You ask a really good question, which is what happens to what does get passed? Are we going to have a situation by the time this, you know, eviscerated bill finally gets passed, which is good for real people and which people can afford? And I think, frankly, the answer is no. We've killed the only part of the bill which was likely to bring costs down. And yes, as Megan says, in bringing costs down, that would have hurt the health insurers. That was kind of the point.
Well, you know, it seems to me that there are just so many important things on the president's plate. I wonder whether the healthcare debate is at all affecting the ability to get any financial regulation done. You know, I mean, aren't we supposed to be fixing the economy, Felix?
We are. And the urgency of financial regulation is very much front and center right now, because if we don't get something done this year, by the time 2010 rolls around, the crisis is going to be history. And frankly, with health care reform being such an enormous distraction to Congress, the chances of getting anything done, remember, we're in the fourth quarter now already, seem pretty slim.
And Megan, we are now a year out from the crisis. So, I mean, if we can't get anything done at this point, I wonder if memories will start to fade.
I think it's not clear, and here's why. If you look at the history of the U.S. financial regulation in the wake of the Great Depression, it actually didn't get kicked off immediately. You know, the political capital to make really deep and radical changes to the financial system came out of a much deeper and more drastic crisis than it looks like we're now going to have.
And remember that in 1933, of course, you didn't have a huge system of entrenched regulators who were desperate to keep hold of their current turf and to stop regulation from happening. You can always introduce new regulations, because what you're doing is you're creating a regulator who has power, and he goes, yay, I've got power and I can regulate people, and people love doing that. But when you go up to existing regulators and you say, actually, you're just complicating matters and you're making things worse rather than better, so we're going to abolish you, well, they don't really react very well to that.
Well, if it does happen, if we do get a new regulator of some sort, I'll be waiting for them to say yay. The weekly wrap on Wall Street with our friends Felix Salmon of Reuters and Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine. Thanks, both of you guys. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Tess.
Thank you.
week in its latest attempt to be included in every part of our waking lives, Google rolled out its next big idea. It's called Google Wave, dude. The search engine giant is billing Wave as a personal communication and collaboration tool. Only, as commentator John Moe tells us, not everyone gets to ride this wave.
Dear Google, can you see me? I'm waving at you. Will you wave back? This week, you sent out the first batch of invitations to join your new service, Google Wave. They went to your closest friends. Apparently, I'm not among your closest friends. And those friends were granted invites to share with their friends, and then the online mania began. Invites were showing up on eBay with bids near $160, and over something intangible. It's not like when the new PlayStation comes out and manufacturing can't keep up with demand and everything slows down. You invented this scarcity, Google, so we would want to be a part of Wave. Well, it worked. Google Wave, according to you, is what email would look like if it were imagined today. It would integrate all the ways I connect with people electronically. Email, social media, instant messaging, wikis, all in one giant command center, on a browser, on my computer. The communication tool of tomorrow. So what does that mean? I wish I knew. I've read countless articles about it, watched an hour-long presentation by your developers. I've devoted myself to understanding you, and I still don't know really how Wave works or what it does. Maybe it's a completely useless solution to a problem we don't have. I still want in. Now, late last night, I got an email from my friend Julio, and he has an extra invite. It might take a few days, but he thinks he can pass my name along to you guys and have it work. So you don't love me, but Julio said I can tag along to your party. Okay, I said. Because even though you hurt me, Google, and shunned me, maybe Wave is really fantastic. More than just hype. The next Google search instead of the next Google most of the other things you make. And if not, if Wave is just some big dumb flop, I want to be a part of it anyway. Okay. Keep in touch. Call or just wave. Love, John.
John Moe is a producer for American Public Media. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact or, you know, wave. Coming up, we'll introduce you to the man who made Macau magnificent.
He's clearly the equivalent of, I don't know, Warren Buffett in the U.S. with an extra thing that he's a very seductive man. Even when you have a room full of tycoons, he's really one of a kind.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some disappointing jobs news gave Wall Street the blues today. The Dow inched down 0.25%, 21 points, to close at 9,487. The Nasdaq dropped almost 0.5%, 9 points, ending at 2048. The S&P 500 also slipped nearly 0.5%, 4 points, to close at 1027. For the week, the Dow fell 1.8%. The Nasdaq lost 2.1%, and the S&P shed 1.8%. News: the factory orders fell in August pulled the rug out from under some industrial companies. General Electric fizzled more than 3.75%. Honeywell fell more than 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine is announced in Stockholm. With summer temperatures cooling into fall, the American Gas Association discusses the winter heating season at the National Press Club. And on October 5th, 1950, after a run on radio, You Bet Your Life made its TV debut with Groucho Marx hosting. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. As we mentioned earlier, unemployment is edging closer and closer to 10%. But that means 90% are still employed. We wondered how they're navigating the new office realities. So we decided to ask Jim Davis of the talent management firm DDI. His company recently released a survey taking the temperature of the folks lucky enough to still have a job. Mr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tess. Glad to be here.
You spoke with about 1,000 workers, non-management types, about their perspectives on work. What did you hear?
We were somewhat surprised to hear that over half of these workers feel that their careers are stagnant or in limbo.
And did they tell you why?
Yes, they did. How I would term this is they said that they were in the know. They had no challenging assignments. They have no opportunities to learn new skills. They have no room to advance. They get no recognition. And they have no line of sight to how their jobs fit in with the objectives of the organization.
Then how do those feelings of stagnation manifest themselves in the workplace? What's happening?
People are going to actively seek new jobs as the economy improves. People are saying things like, I just do what's asking me, nothing more, nothing less. I just do my job and go home. Hmm. As opposed to people that say, I'm interested in what I do. I'm excited about going to work. And it has a negative impact on productivity and quality and customer service and organizations.
Frankly, that just sounds like a bad tude.
It may be a bad tude. We did ask people, what they're doing about it, and individuals are not going and talking to their boss about their future. 42% of the people that DDI surveyed have not had those kind of conversations, and we think that that would be important for people to be able to make some changes and to do some things differently.
Did they say why they're not talking to the boss about their unhappiness?
No, they didn't say why they're not talking to the boss, but they did tell us some of the other things that they were doing. We found that people were more likely to do things like watch YouTube videos or check their Facebook site than to help a fellow employee with work or to take on extra assignments. And we also found that one out of every five people are calling in playing hooky at work when they could be at work.
Oh my goodness. That is really counterintuitive to me, given the job situation in this country. I mean, yeah, you can be unhappy at work, but isn't this kind of the worst time to display that?
I agree with that. And like I say, we were sort of surprised to see that figure come up, that it does seem like it would be a time to be at work every day, to
right.
be working hard, to be doing all that you can do. I think that people, because they feel that their workloads have increased so much, 53% of the people in the DDI study felt that their workload has increased 25% or more. And I think we get a little bit of, well, I'm entitled to a day off here or there, which is a terrible attitude to have.
Then how can companies motivate their workers now? You know, there are not a lot of raises coming. Bonuses have gone the way of the dodo bird, unless you're the CEO. Promotions probably not likely in this economic situation. How do you motivate a worker?
I think we go back to some of those areas that we would call the land of the no and turn those into the land of the yes. Hmm. So we look to give workers challenging assignments. We look to take these times to develop new skills in people, and we look to provide recognition. We're probably not going to be able to provide room to advance right now, but we can do recognition, build skills, and create challenging assignments.
Jim Davis is with the talent management firm DDI, and we've been talking about their survey of the current American workforce. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you for having me, Tess.
The gambling capital of the world has recovered from the recession. You thought I was talking about Vegas? Hardly. In the Chinese territory of Macau, casino earnings surged in August. Operators are dusting off plans for new and even more garish gaming halls. But for all the glee, an air of unease hangs over Macau. The 87-year-old undisputed godfather of the gambling scene there has been hospitalized for weeks. And the somewhat ghoulish question has surfaced, if and when Stanley Ho departs the scene, what's next for Macau? Our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong reports.
It's hard to visit Macau and not bump into Stanley Ho's empire. hop the ferry over from Hong Kong. It's run by daughter Pansy Ho's company. Catch the animated light show at Macau's brand new resort, the City of Dreams. Son Lawrence Ho is part owner. In all, Stanley Ho owns 20 of Macau's 32 gaming houses. The 87-year-old billionaire has seen his share of political change and rivalry, but he's always stayed on top.
He's clearly the equivalent of, I don't know, Warren Buffett in the U.S.
Macau long-timer and political scientist Eric Saw today.
With an extra thing that he's a very seductive man. Even when you have a room full of tycoons, he's really one of a kind.
Ho's original casino from the 1970s helps tell the story. The Lisboa is mostly baccarat tables. No lounge singers, no tiger shows, no frills. Saw today remembers the old days.
Very smoky atmosphere, not well ventilated, with old carpets, Russian prostitutes going around.
Ho's other secret is private gambling rooms. The high rollers you never see here generate 65% of Macau's fortunes. And from the mid-1960s to 2004, Stanley Ho controlled it all, says Kathy Xu at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University.
He married a woman who helped him to get the monopoly license. And then his second wife has some relationship with organized crime, so he didn't encounter any major problems in terms of challenging his monopoly.
In 1999, Macau reverted from Portuguese colonial rule back to China. So Stanley Ho shifted his emphasis to mainland gamblers. Then in 2004, his monopoly ended. The American developer Las Vegas Sands opened two casinos, including the famous Venetian. Others, like MGM and Wynn Resorts, came too, but they stumbled. Xu says most Chinese gamblers blew off all the nice restaurants and the frou-frou hotel rooms.
So I think the investment was misdirected.
So Stanley Ho today is still winning Macau's market share, though he is modernizing. The Lisboa has cleaner carpets now, free drinks, and the prostitutes have moved to the basement. And Ho has placed a side bet on that Vegas neon model, which two of his children have invested in. Eric Sautaday figures it's a smooth succession plan, unless there's family feud when Ho dies.
In a way, it's even more than complicated than the Kennedys, for the simple reason that Tan Leo had four wives, and I'm counting really the official ones.
Plus, 17 children are in the picture. Local columnist and economist Jose Duarte.
Then we have his business associates. They have probably been running most of the company for the last years. Then you have the other shareholders. There are too many variables, too many unknowns here.
Which makes for palace intrigue with Ho in the hospital. Whatever happens to him, his business record speaks for itself. And not many people here are betting against the godfather's empire. In Macau, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the ghost of Bernie Madoff came back to haunt his family today. The court-appointed trustee overseeing restitution for his victims sued Madoff's brother, sons, and a niece. Irving Picard accuses those family members of using the business as a, quote, piggy bank. The lawsuit demands that they return some $200 million for redistribution to investors who fell prey to Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Madoff is serving a 150-year prison term after pleading guilty to the fraud. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost a quarter of a percent, 21 points. The Nasdaq dropped 9 points, nearly half a percent. And the S&P 500 slid nearly a quarter of a percent, 4 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up on Monday, how Monty Python celebrates the comedy and tragedy of real life.
We used to live in this tiny old tumble-down house with great big holes in the roof. House? You were lucky to live in a house. We used to live in one room, all 26 of us, no furniture, half the floor was missing. We were all huddled together in one corner for fear of falling.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.